Hello, welcome to Creative Disturbance. My name is Yvan Tina. I am the host of the Metalife channel. And today it's my great pleasure to be talking with Camilla Pang in London. Hello, Camilla.
Hello.
Hi, Camilla, we met through Facebook a couple months ago. You're doing a PhD in bioinformatics, but can you please introduce yourself in a few words?
Yes, hi. I've just graduated from my PhD from UCL, studying structural bioinformatics, and I'm now working at a pharmaceutical company working with machine learning in analyzing data for antibody-based therapeutics.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. So as you said, you're studying biochemistry and protein structures, and your main research area focuses on the finding driver genes and mutation in cancer and how this impacts cancer evolution and heterogeneity, according to what you told me. So talking about heterogeneous data in the short discussion we had before recording, can you please tell us more about that and which kind of data are you dealing with?
Yeah, so heterogeneous data is just basically looking at systems that have that exhibit natural variance, which is almost every system that you encounter. So there's always one exception to the rule that doesn't quite fit in. And whether that be a subculture or within the whole population, all of it forms part of the spectrum that makes up the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the types of data that I've encountered within formal education have mainly been about local microscale events, and specifically cancer and disease mutation data, which are on different levels of biological abstraction, such as in networks, such as on the gene level, such as on the protein level, or even the cellular level or tissue level. Mm-hmm. And my work here is to try and map these events from the atomic and cellular level to outcomes in higher order scales, such as disease states and phenotype. So those all contain heterogeneity because it's trying to elucidate cause from effect. And there are obviously many different causes that have the same effect. But other types of data that I've worked with are a more global or macro scale, such as psychological data, particularly is very informative, as this enables a top-down approach and also very complementary to considering the local events alone. So for these, I've looked at dementia, psychological, social and community-based data within my side projects. And it's interesting to see how such events intertwine with each other. And this forms the basis of my increase in complexity science.
Okay. But with the rise of bioinformatics, which relies on a reductionist approach, how do you approach life? Are you a reductionist?
God, that's not the question.
I know. But how do you approach life, basically?
As a bioinformatician?
Yeah.
So since doing bioinformatics, because I was originally had a wet lab background, it was protein purification all the way, and since doing bioinformatics, it's really opened my mind to how everything has its biases. We will never have enough data. That's just granted. We won't ever have enough data, even though at this day and age, we have a profuse amount of data. Mm-hmm. But the magic is, what do we do with it? How do we make the most of all this effort and data gathering, and what do we want from it? And it shows the importance of how you look at your data, especially when considering these different levels of abstraction and how it can be organized and in turn put together. And before, I just took these categorizations as standard, like this is a driver mutation, this is a passenger mutation, only to actually realize that they're often ever-evolving, despite them being represented as cold, hard numbers. So it's made me more critical information and its source, and it's just been more curious. But yeah, we're in a world where there will always be missing data, as a lot of it hasn't happened yet.
Okay, thank you very much. As an expert on DNA and evolution, what's your take on the evolution in our understanding of DNA?
So, evolution, survival of the fittest, there are so many different biological, sociological, and psychological like selection pressures at bay. And so the dimensionality of fitness has actually increased. So there are many different solutions and interpretations of fitness these days, whatever people define that is, which is often correlated with the types of features which govern it. But in terms of how this is reflected in the evolution of DNA, yes, genetic plays an important role, granted, but also much like described in the book Not In Your Genes by Oliver James, which is a great read, by the way, there are so many more determining factors, including epigenetics, which engender fitness. After all, fitness, it all depends on what type of outcome is of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Personality is a big factor, especially these days, and nurture is definitely important.
Okay, so I would like to come back to my previous question. So given the influence of mathematics and informatics in your research, would you consider yourself a reductionist?
Short answer, no. I tried to be, and at times is essential. But over time, I got increasingly frustrated, as I knew there was a lot more than considering an event in isolation. Like, I'm a big fan and advocate for landscape theory and also complexity theory. And there are many different types of problems in science, some of which require a top-down or bottom-up approach, depending on the level of biological abstraction. Like, to study local events, then you can be. But in order to see how these fit into the bigger, more integrative picture, you need a higher dimension of seeing how these events link together, such as in network theory. So this is not trivial. For example, in molecular dynamics, to model the global picture of protein movement, you need to consider how each individual structure over time reflects the dynamics of the whole picture, which is why time is very important in sampling. And this whole phenomena, it forms the basis of the ergodic theory in statistical physics. So generalization is okay to a certain extent, but it can overlook a lot of the detail needed to really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So other methods, such as complexity science, help ease this pain of reductionism.
Okay, complexity against reductionism. That's my takeaway from what you just said. Okay, so talking about this evolution of DNA, in an article that I read from the MIT Technology Review a couple of years ago, I learned that we could now engineer the human genome through the use of CRISPR technology. CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeat. And CRISPR Cas9 is a special technique for editing DNA, which functions as genetic scissors and enable scientists to target more precisely a piece of DNA and to replace it with a different DNA sequence. So with this in mind, how do you think CRISPR genome editing will transform your fields of research?
So it definitely enables a greater feasibility to study the direct effects of editing specific portions of the genome in the most native environment possible, which is paramount to seeing its true effect. Mm-hmm. I think it's really good that technologies like this are enabling to edit the genome with such precision. Mm-hmm. But recent evidence does show that it introduces more mutations than anticipated. And so using it within gene therapy at this stage, it would need some work and development to make sure it's safe. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely the first step to creating a cure for such genetic diseases. So actually this week, there has been a new variant of CRISPR called CRISPR-Skip, which doesn't use a cut-and-paste methodology, but instead changes individual points within the sequence and so is associated with a much lower error mutation rate. So mm-hmm. it's already improving as we speak.
So this happened this week?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this happened this week. Well, I just heard about it on when it was published. I looked at it and I thought, it made me feel very positive that it's good that it's being developed, because this is potentially a very powerful tool. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it wins the Nobel Prize at some point.
Okay.
It's going to be very impactful.
Okay.
But in terms of curing evolutionary diseases such as cancer, theoretically, we could track which genetic changes occur and how these evolve over time, and then accurately alter them with precision. We could iteratively use CRISPR to target genes that are shown to drive cancer evolution. But we do need to be careful, as cases like cancer are unpredictable by nature. So we would be editing in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess that there are obviously many ethical issues at stake, such as being able to design babies and living spaces.
Yeah.
But it is somewhat something that, as a scientist, frightens you. I mean, is it something that frightens you? And if not, why?
No, this is something that doesn't frighten me, because with every new emerging and progressive technology, there is always some fear and resistance, which is good, because thank goodness we have this, because it puts us into perspective into what we are able to do and to make us more wary of its implications, preparing mm-hmm. us for the worst case scenario or something we haven't considered. Take AI, for example. It all depends on how it's used and how well it can be traced and controlled. You can't help the inevitable evolution of technology in itself. Mm-hmm. And it puts my mind at peace. And if anything, it just encourages me to know more. It's just how it's used.
Mm-hmm. And so
no, it doesn't frighten me.
With CRISPR and similar technologies, what will happen to our current model of Darwinian evolution? And by the way, is the Darwinian evolution still the prevalent model in evolution theory?
So, as humans have evolved, we have somewhat lost our traditional ability in evolving to adapt to our immediate environment, because we have actually evolved to have the ability to change our environment to suit our needs. So I think other types of adaptation have occurred,
mm-hmm.
where we are subject to both inter and also intra-species selection pressures, mm-hmm. which are forming one of the main determinants of success. And I think there can be more said on this later in the podcast, because this is quite a big subject.
But what did you meant earlier when you said that since we're more complex than a single cell organism, one could argue that our cognition ability could be a defense mechanism?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Consciousness is a very controversial subject, because we still don't really know what it is exactly. It's almost very ethereal. So we're more than just the sum of our parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's how each of these parts intricately interact. So instinct, which is, I guess, an element of cognition, is innately programmed within all of us, like many animals. But it is without doubt that our ability to forward think and project the future separates us mm-hmm. from other species, and in turn has offered us humans a greater advantage. And for this to occur, communication between humans is imperative for this process. And we move as a unity, as a culture. And we humans, compared to other animals, seem to have an innate gift for, which has given us a great advantage.
Mm-hmm. So then, can we say that cognition could be the extension of evolution? And I guess, if so, is the future of evolution the evolution of things like consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, to acknowledge cognition, we must almost importantly acknowledge that it's not linear and it's not logical. And mm-hmm. even though you're like, well, logic is cognition, but it's not necessarily, because everyone's got a different version of it. So therefore, by definition, it's not linear. And it encapsulates the mind's process beyond the neurotypical, where formal logic is only a subset of it. So, for example, empathy and the ability to foresee links between elements and how they interact mm-hmm. from local to global view would be imperative for the modelling of more complex systems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently performing such side projects that look at different types of psychology, including those with mental health conditions and dementia, to see how different people are wired, because I think it's definitely going to be important in the field of machine learning. Mm-hmm. And I'm currently in the process of writing a blog about this.
Okay. I just want to wrap up this first part of the podcast, and I'm going to ask you one last question, which is more like a speculation. So are we going to lose the biological and chemical substrates of life over the years? What do you think?
Well, in terms of uploading our consciousness to other forms, yeah. like on the Matrix,
mm-hmm.
I think it's definitely going to be interesting to see, but in terms of us not being carbon-based, we could just then think about other elements on other planets and how different life forms could form.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even now, with there have been studies looking at chirality and how this affects evolution or life on other planets. This is something quite in the astrobiology field, which is very interesting itself. But it depends on what we're going to use it for, technology or just the natural evolution of chemistry.
Okay. Thank you so much, Camilia.
You
can find more information on this podcast on the on creativedisturbance.org.